Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next episode of Vassals of Kingsway's epic linear read of GRRM's A Song of Ice and Fire series. This is episode 52 of the reread, and today we'll be covering Tyrion 6, Davos 5, and Tyrion 7 from A Storm of Swords. This episode will contain spoilers for all published books in the Song of Ice and Fire series. Today I'm joined by Jock.
Hello, Jock. My little Jock to you on the forums.
I'm Matt.
Hey, Varley on the forums.
Tanya.
Hi, this is Tanya. Silence on the forums.
Mary.
Hi, everyone. It's Mary and Nymeria on the forums.
And Noah.
Pops AA on the forums, here temporarily.
Okay, so the last chapter we covered was Jon 7 from A Storm of Swords. And now we're going back a couple of chapters to Tyrion 6, which happens 2 days later on the 20th of December 299. I believe this is Jock's chapter.
Yes. During this chapter, Tyrion starts off the chapter being irritated by the Martells and the Tyrells who have been fighting all around the town. He's been trying to keep them separate, but somehow they manage to find each other and start a quarrel. After that, he tries not to take out on Sansa, who after dinner goes off to the Godswood to play. Which he seems to have a big problem with, because why the fuck wouldn't he? Seems to be bored, so she leaves, and then after that he's looking through Littlefinger's scribbles, not being able to figure out what the fuck he's been doing all this time. After that he goes off to see Tywin, who's with the various incest crew, and Pycelle. Let's hope he's not. All of whom seem to be very happy with themselves. Tyrion then finds out about the Red Wedding, which leads Rosalind caught a fine fat fowl. Her brothers gave her a pair of wolf pelts for a wedding. Tyrion immediately thinks of Sansa and observes that kings are falling like leaves this autumn. Tywin warns that he should not be complacent. But Cersei protests that the Riverlords will surely sue for peace now that there are no longer any bothersome northern men to support them. Tywin agrees that they will all eventually bend the knee, but has sent off the mountain that leads to Harrenhal to try and get rid of all them. Joffrey surprisingly after that challenges Tywin, claiming he was scared of Aelys, the Mad King. That Robert won all the battles while Tywin sat and hid in Casterly Rock. This turns out not to be as good an idea, as Joffrey is quickly dismissed by Tywin, and then calls him Aerys the Third. Tyrion then congratulates Tywin on his success, but is shocked to learn that Tywin does not intend to give Rhaegar Clegane's head to Mobley Martell, and has decided instead that Aemery Lorch should instead be sent. Tyrion then is confused by Tywin telling him that Arya Stark is to marry Luce Bolton's son. After pointing this out, Tywin replies, "So was Langley until the Blackwater." And I believe that's all of the chapter.
Yeah, I feel like Tyrion's chapters have so many important characters in them. They have so much information.
Not the next one.
When the next one is like really short. but these chapters where they're having councils and everything, there's a lot of information in these chapters. I believe this is the first time that we get We heard Tywin talking about the sack of King's Landing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the first time too. I'm not entirely sure, but it was really interesting to have the account of someone who was actually there, like Jaime, but on another part of the whole thing. And I found it interesting that Tywin acknowledged that he didn't have full control over what was happening, and that they came to the cause late, so they had to put up a show of loyalty, but he didn't expect Aemery Lorch to be so brutal and stuff like that.
And Gregor.
And Gregor, yeah.
Yeah. But it's amazing how it seems even more brutal coming from him. Like, even Tywin Lannister is questioning why it took like 50 stabs to kill a little child, or you know, why Elia had to be raped.
It's really horrific, yeah, to have the actual account of this.
Yeah, and even then Tywin is talking about it in such a clinical way that it's even more chilling.
Yeah.
Brother Lannisters continue to be as huggable as ever.
Joffrey is terrible in this chapter. Even when he says, you know, I want Rob's head so I can serve it to Sansa at my wedding. And Kevin Lannister is
like,
so
even shocked. Even for Joffrey, I think that's pretty fucked up.
I think that's kind of the chapter where they acknowledge how crazy Joffrey is and how terrible a king he will be if he continues on that path.
Yeah, Tywin is trying to rein him in, but...
Yeah, the Aerith the Third, and it's so true. And even Tywin is like, what the fuck? I was led to believe that he wouldn't be such a little shit, but yeah.
Certainly puts a shit sack in supreme heroic shit sack of syphilic dickheads. I think that describes him.
Cersei is like trying to sweep it under the rug again when she says, you know, Robert knocked out a few of his Joffrey's baby teeth because of a little fuss about a cat. When, I don't remember exactly, but didn't he skin that cat?
No, the cat had kittens inside of it, so Joffrey cut it open to see, like normal people do.
Ugh. I forget just
and
how horrible Joffrey was.
And Cersei doesn't even care.
Yeah.
He was, I just remember that it was, I think, Tommen's cat.
Anyway. Sir Pounce?
Joffrey is... No, it wasn't Sir Pounce.
Lady,
Sir Pounce.
Lady
he doesn't
Whiskers.
Help them, yeah.
Lady Whiskers. I love Tommen's cats.
Yeah, and thankfully, Joffrey dies.
It's crazy that Tommen is such a normal kid when you see his mother, his brother. The whole thing is just crazy.
Yeah, it's really weird how differently they turned out, and I wonder.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess Joffrey does have that perspective on the power of becoming king, whereas Tommen doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
But don't you figure that that's what like normally happens? Is like, yeah, there's a bunch of crazy people, and like there's like one guy sitting there going like, what the fuck are you guys caring about this like little like really? Like, is this important to you? Like, and then he becomes king and he's like, why the fuck is this important to everyone then? That's, I think, Aegon the Fourth or Egg.
I mean Aegon the Fifth.
Alright, you know what? Fact check later.
Back to the anus game.
But yeah, so, both Myrcella and Tommen turned out surprisingly normal.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
true.
I don't think we know.
Weird circumstances.
I don't think we know about Myrcella yet. Like, she seems normal, but she just had, like, half of her face cut off, so who knows.
Yeah, that might be some
yeah,
kind of a trauma
she,
for
yeah.
her.
She could still lose it, but I don't know, she seemed a pretty okay kid. Like, I feel like anything's okay compared to Joffrey.
Yeah. Maybe also
I mean,
Cersei had less of an influence on them because she was so much about Joffrey, and didn't care about the other two that much. I mean, she does care about them, but it seems like Joffrey has always been her main focus.
Yeah, but Joffrey's a pretty low bar, it's like.
Yeah.
True, very true.
Like,
but yeah, but maybe Cersei just doesn't impart as much of her craziness on the other two because she's just so busy with Joffrey.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. Maybe.
So I think it was interesting to have this conversation between Tywin and Tyrion, and like the way Tywin really dismisses Cersei and like has absolutely no respect for her intelligence, or he's like, just go away, you fucked up with Joffrey. And on the other hand, even though he hates Tyrion and there's obviously something very wrong between the two. He kind of respects him, like in this discussion, he talks to him not like they're equals, but he explains to him what he did and what's going to happen, and they actually have a discussion, even though there's really nothing to discuss. But I mean, it's really different how he talks to Cersei and how he talks to Tyrion, even though he despises Tyrion.
Yeah, and at one point he's almost like as if he's trying to teach Tyrion something when he's saying, you know, that you talk too much, you give away your secrets. When you're planning something, you should keep it close to the chest.
Yeah.
Like, it's like he's kind of trying to, like, bond and teach his son something. Whereas with Cersei, he's very dismissive.
Yeah.
I mean, we know Cersei isn't exactly smart.
Yeah, but it also... I think it's still saying something that he treats them very differently. Like, he has more respect for Cersei's... he thinks she's important for the honor of the house, and that Tyrion is not. I mean, he only lessens the house, but he does respect his intellect, I think.
I think he's seen that Tyrion actually did a pretty decent job as Hand. So I feel like before he sent Tyrion to King's Landing, he didn't really consider how Tyrion could be important for their family. But I think he understands now that Tyrion might, you know, get ruling better than Jaime. Can we just move on to how horrible Tyrion and Sansa's marriage is? It's just so emotionless that it's almost painful.
Do you think that's about the same as any other arranged marriage where it's, I mean, obviously, like, there's not a a little person there. Like, it's just, like, two people that are not attracted to each other that are expected to have sex and procreate. I mean, I do think that's the whole thing about
being married to someone from the family that killed your dad. I think that would be quite...
Well, yeah, yeah.
So, I think that does kind of... I wonder what most arranged marriages in Westeros are like, but I do think that this is particularly strained because of the political situation surrounding it.
Yeah, and I think Tyrion directly addresses it. It's like, oh, when do you think she'll be ready to have children? Like, after I tell her, like, our family killed her family, or before? Like, when will she be ready?
I feel like Sansa has been... Like, Sansa's trusted people one too many times at this point in King's Landing, and I think she just refused, because by nature, I feel like Sansa is a person who wants to trust people, but she can't trust a Lannister anymore. Even I feel like if circumstances had been slightly different, she might have been able to maybe perhaps forget that. She wouldn't forget, but she would move past the fact that Tyrion is a dwarf. But
yeah,
it's just something that she can't overcome.
Yeah, and I think with a bit of she probably would have been fine, but not in those circumstances.
Yeah, although she does seem to understand Tyrion pretty well. Like, she says, yeah, you don't want to go to the gods, but you're going to hate it.
I think in different circumstances, those two would have made a really good couple in a way, I think. I think, like, if it wasn't, I don't know.
Sonia, that has been explored in thousands of fan fictions, in case you're interested in wanting to see it play out.
Not particularly, but I do think it's still... I mean, there is obviously the whole underlying issue of forcing, I guess, both of them into that marriage, which is maybe not a good practice to begin with. But if we accept that this is a world where arranged marriages are just what happens, then I think there's worse matches than those two, except for the whole issue of his family killing her family. It's not so good.
Yeah.
Anyone else have anything about this chapter? Other than the, oh yeah, I remembered the whole Tyrell-Martell situation. Apparently Olenna Tyrell has been very rude, which is not
surprising. Yeah, that kind of surprised me. Because she's usually more... She's frank, but she's also more subtle.
Does she? I feel like Olenna Tyrell has no clue there.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, like, she works behind the drapes, you know. She doesn't openly confront. Yeah, she does, actually. She doesn't care. Okay.
I feel like openly she hates everyone. Like, she's mean to everyone. So you can't figure out who she likes and who she doesn't like. Like, yeah, she even says terrible stuff about her own children.
Yeah.
So,
Is this the first time we hear about the fake Arya plot? Or did we?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think anyone has mentioned Arya in a long time.
Yeah.
So I feel like this is the first
time. Start of a clash of kings, I think.
Yeah.
And we also get an idea of everything Littlefinger has been doing with the money. And I guess it's just a reminder that he's shady and does a lot of stuff that we don't we don't really know what he does, but he's working his magic, I guess.
Yeah, but it seems like Littlefinger is like way ahead of his time when he says, you know, that money shouldn't just be sitting around. He's obviously, you know, investing it in places and moving it around, and he might not exactly be doing the right thing. Like, he's probably doing a little cheating here and there, but otherwise it seems to be like he really does seem to have a head for
definitely
making money.
Definitely, but it shows that while he was master of coins, he basically did everything he wanted, and that no one had any control over what he did with the money, and that they cannot make sense of it afterwards. So
yeah, I don't think anyone can understand what he's doing with money.
And that's the whole thing, right? No one thinks that Littlefinger has actual power. Everyone is like, he's not really a highborn. I mean, he is, but very low highborn. So no one cares. He doesn't have any power. But I mean, he's been given a free pass to do basically whatever he wanted with the crown's money. So,
but it's amazing how much power he's managed to get his hands onto. Like, even Tyrion notices. He tries to point out to Tywin that I don't think he actually says it to Tywin, but he notices that we're basically handing everything to Littlefinger. Like, when Tywin is ordering the Mountain to go and get rid of the Bloody Mummers, that means Harrenhal will just be free for Littlefinger if he chooses to, you know, make it his own. And the point of giving him Harrenhal was that you couldn't actually take it because there were so many people fighting over it. But now Tywin is just like clearing the path for Littlefinger.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, the Lannisters just trust him. And
yeah,
don't
blindly, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I think they just don't think they think that if he wants to betray them, he'll have no power to do it because all his power comes from them, but it's not true. And he only imagines the usual way of betraying. He doesn't imagine that Littlefinger is doing all of that behind his back. I mean, which is crazy because Tywin just orchestrated the Red Wedding, so he should be able to imagine that someone could do that to him, but he doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, he basically allowed Littlefinger to go and marry Lysa Arryn, right? Which gives him control over one of the seven kingdoms. And
well, no, because he's still Lord of Harrenhal, so now he's Lord of Harrenhal plus, like, Protectorate of the
Exactly, Aaron. Isn't that a lot of power?
That's a lot.
Yeah, it is. And it's crazy that Tywin just hands everything over to Littlefinger without realizing that he has the power to... I mean, yeah, it's just... Harrenhal felt like an empty title, that was supposed to allow him to marry Lysa Arryn, but with that, he gave him much more than an empty title.
I mean, we'll see, because now that he's, like, heir apparent or whatever to the Aerie, Robert Aaron is still alive, and we don't know, like, what they're going to do.
He gets his power, like, through Robert Aaron, right? That's how he... Otherwise, he would have no claim to the Aerie. He can only control Robert and use it to his advantage while he still can. I think that's... Isn't he... What's his plan with Harry Harding? Is he going to have... I feel like his plan would be get Sansa married to Harry.
And kill off Robin. And,
yeah, and kill him off as soon as they have a child. So he can control Sansa and the child.
Yeah, but how does he control them once they gain power?
Everything he's doing about Sansa right now is he's teaching her, he's being her mentor, and he also influences her in so many ways that he can expect her to be always looking up to him and being really under his influence psychologically, emotionally, and intellectually, like, tell me what to do, Peter. So, I mean...
I feel like he's trying to exert
influence over her.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily convinced that this is going to work out, but I think in his mind, he's pretty sure he's got Sansa and he doesn't have to worry about...
Yeah, I agree. I agree that it's not... Yeah, it's not necessarily going to work.
Totally, yeah, but I think
he thinks it is.
Yeah.
I feel like he's trying to exert influence over Sansa exactly the same way he did with Lysa, and that worked for, like, decades, right? So I think he's just starting to get a little complacent about having the same influence over Sansa. So I think that's going to be his downfall. I hope that's going to be his downfall.
Well, there was something about tapestries, because he was getting a tapestry from King's Landing to the Eyrie.
Yeah, and tapestries, I think, multiple. I feel like, could they be all the Targaryen tapestries? Because those things Robert had, like, taken down and stored away. So could those be the ones? Is this, like, little thing actually about Dany and how she could possibly invade Westeros? I don't know. I mean, why else would those tapestries be significant enough that we hear about them?
Smuggle something out.
Yeah, possibly.
Because my idea is that he's been debasing the currency this whole time and stolen all the excess gold from himself. So I think at some point he's going to reveal that the currency is worth a lot less than it actually is. That will cause even more chaos.
Now we're moving on to Davos 5, which is also the next chapter in the published order. And this happens a week later on the 27th of December, 299. Matt?
From Tower of the Hand. Celador approaches Davos after he leaves and says he forgives him for turning down the plan to raid Claw Isle. He says Davos has many enemies among the Queen's men, but he is making friends as well. Davos has been courting those who think that Stannis has turned from the gods to a demon of shadow, including Sir Gerald Gower, who fought well on the Blackwater, Sir Andrew, who once squired for Stannis, and Sir Roland, who commanded the rear guard as Stannis escaped from King's Landing. Davos goes to see Pylos and laments his lack of skill at hand, saying he is not a highborn lord or a great knight. Pylos counters that Sirram Redwine was the greatest knight of his day. Septon Merison was a miracle worker. Lord Butterwell was witty. Miles Smallwood was courageous, and Sir Otto Hightower was learned. But they were all terrible hands. Kinship is no guide either. Maegor Targaryen is a terrible hand, while Baelor Breakspear was a great one. On the other hand, there was Septon Barth, a blacksmith's son, who Jaehaerys I elevated from the Red Keep library and give him 40 years of peace and prosperity. Davos insisted he is unworthy because he cannot even read, and Pylo said he would teach him. And he started that very day. Several days later, Patchface waits outside the door for a lesson to finish as Davos approaches. Inside, Pylos is just finishing instructing Eric, Devin, and Shirin. They're reading of Darren the First and his conquest of Dorne. But Edric is not impressed because his father once won 3 battles in one day. He's referring to the early days of Robert's Rebellion when Lords Granderson, Catherine, and Fel decided to join forces at Summerhall, and put an end to Robert's insurrection. Robert learned of the plan and moved from Storm's End in time to take each lord one by one as they arrived, personally slaying Lord Fel and capturing his son Silveraxe. Pylos tells Edric not to boast, reminding him that Robert was not invincible, losing the battle against Lord Mace at Ashford, as well as many tournaments. After they leave, Pylos suggests Davos himself reads Daron's Conquest of Dorne, but he asks for a letter to read instead. There are no new ones, so Pylos chooses an old one. It is a letter from Bowen asking the 5 kings for aid. Davos is shocked to hear of the troubles at the Wall and realizes that the Watch must be desperate if they're asking Stannis for help, since he has little strength left. He thinks of the first time he saw the Wall serving on a ship called the Cobblecat. Ship's captain, Roro Uhoris, was a Tyroshi nicknamed the Blind Bastard, despite neither being blind nor bastard-born, that decided to trade with the wildling settlements along the Bay of Seals. The ship was caught by galleys out of Eastwatch, and Roro was executed for smuggling. Davos remembers the wildlings he met on the trip and thinks that they were no worse than any other men, though one did steal the ship's cabin girl. He asks Stannis if he had seen the letter, and Pylos states that he had given it to Lord Alistair when they arrived. Davos considers that the letter might portend for the future and asks Pylos for a less troubling letter.
Yeah, again, news of the Red Wedding. It's even Davos says, you know, the Freys are going to be cursed now because they broke, like, guest right. And it's, wow. And the whole 2 is not 3 thing, when Stannis points out, you know, a king can count as well as a smuggler, 2 kings is not 3, Joffrey is still alive. And Melisandre says, what if Joffrey dies surrounded by his subjects and his king's guard? And I felt like Melisandre has already seen Joffrey's death, like, because that's a really accurate description of how he dies, right? He's surrounded by everyone, but yeah, still somebody manages to get the poison to him. So I feel like Melisandre has at least interpreted this vision correctly.
Yeah, that seems quite likely, I'd say.
Yeah, but...
yeah.
But Rob, you know, died amongst his, you know, Kingsguard and everyone else too. But so I don't think that's.
Yeah, but Bob.
Well, yeah, he also died at a wedding. But then I feel like Rob had a lot more enemies there than Joffrey does.
Honestly, I really think that Melisandre just sees all of that, and. Then she makes a show of the leeches and stuff like that to convince people that it was her.
Do you think that she thinks it was her? Yeah. I mean, do you think she maybe sees the visions and then thinks that she has the power to bring about what she sees in those visions? Because with her, I'm never quite sure. Because I think most of what she says is bullshit, but I'm never sure how much she's aware of that.
Yeah, so, how much she believes.
Because she believes quite a lot of stuff that's quite...
yeah.
Off, I think.
I'm pretty sure Melisandre knows that the leeches were just a gimmick, but she does believe that she, if she actually had King's blood, and by King's blood, I mean like if she could actually sacrifice someone with King's blood, then she could make a stone dragon. I really believe that she believes that.
Yeah, because otherwise, but I feel like why the leeches push for were. It?
Yeah, but I also think that the leeches were just, you know, there to convince Stannis that Melisandre has some power over
it. I totally agree. And even Stannis kind of, like, he doesn't know, he's not sure, but he's really pragmatic. He's like, if they die, good. But I will still not be sure that it was you. Like, he even says, it's not leeches that killed Robb Stark, it's Walder Frey. And so he's not a fanatic. He's really more pragmatic about this.
Yeah, he does say that. He says, is Rhaelor's hand palsied and spotted?
Yeah. And I like that about him because it makes him a much more interesting character than someone like Solis, who's just like, yay, Rhaelor, Melisandre. Just.
Yeah, Solis is.
Oh, Solis is the worst.
And so
yeah,
it's
she's
kind
a complete
of a
fanatic.
Yeah. It's a recurring theme, I think, in these two chapters, the one we had before and this one, that sometimes you have to kill one person to save many. I mean, that's what Tywin tells Tyrion, like, that it can be more noble to kill 20 people at their wedding than thousands
of people. Yeah, you tell
it. The Westeros version of the trolley problem.
Exactly, exactly. And we see a different vision here. Like, even Stannis, who really is a means for an end type of guy, balks at the idea of murdering Edric Storm. And Davos is clearly like, no, this cannot happen. That's not who we are. So I find it interesting that, I mean, this is obviously a recurring theme in both the linear and the published order, as these two chapters are. Consequential, sequential, whatever, following. Anyway.
But yeah, it's interesting. When Davos starts talking about Edric Storm, he said, you know, he thinks, I am going to take his name as many times as I can,
yeah.
which is, he's just trying to, like, humanize the subject. Like, he's trying to remind Stannis that this is a real person, this is a real child, this is his nephew, even though I feel like Stannis does, like, Stannis is just resisting Melisandre as much as he can. Like, he doesn't intend to give up Edric Storm at all.
I don't think so either, but at the same time, I think that it's a sign, like, against Melisandre, and that Davos, like, is completely against her. Stannis is apprehensive, and that's why, like, he kind of lets this happen.
Yeah. Kind of the same with Brandley, right? He kind of lets it happen.
Yeah, but as they pointed out in the chapter, Brandley was actually a traitor, right?
So yeah, obviously.
Known,
yeah.
It makes more sense. Whereas Edric Storm is just a child who hasn't done anything.
And also, Melisandre, like, much unlike the
no show,
shows,
there's no show spoilers,
she's
no show spoilers,
been
no
actively
spoilers, no
burning. Well, no. But she's been actively burning people in the book.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there have been night fires that, like, and that is fucked up.
But I feel like even Stannis doesn't really believe everything that she says. Like, he doesn't.
Oh, no, I think he really doesn't.
Yeah, like
the does whatever works.
Dragon bullshit. He doesn't really believe it's going to happen, so he's not ready to give up Edric Storm and his principles with him just for the idea of maybe a stone dragon coming back to life.
Well, he even says, like, you know, what good was my sword is as good as any steel on the Blackwater. It didn't help me any.
Yeah.
He knows that. I think he knows that he is not Lightbringer, but, like, he is happy that he's being
Yeah, like he goes with it because it helps his cause that Melisandre is helping him, but he doesn't see himself as the savior of all. Just it's his duty to be king of the Iron of the Seven Kingdoms, and
I think he does both because he does see like in the fire the fist,
yeah,
the
that,
fight
that
of,
comes later
the
though.
Fist
I think it's
man.
Only when he gets to the wall that he kind of takes on the Azor Ahai reborn role.
Yeah, I feel like he just goes along with Melisandre when it suits him. Otherwise, he ignores her advice if it doesn't.
Yeah, that's the impression I'm getting. He'll go along with whatever works, but he does seem fairly skeptical overall.
Yeah, even though he is seeing the visions in the fire.
Yeah, but he accepts that there's a certain power in the Red God religion, but like he doesn't care if Davos mentions gods plural. As we said, he's not a fanatic. He's just And so if he's not a fanatic, he's not gonna be all like, yay, I am the savior, because he doesn't really give a shit.
Which happened in the story, and it's like, oh, there is no other god there. Or I think Melisandre said it. It's like, there's only one god, and it's him and the other. It's like, wait a minute, what? How can you have two gods?
You know, it's just, it's only one god, it's Rolor, and then there's the other, but we must not mention him, so let's say god plural, god singular. But Stannis doesn't care. Like,
yeah, I mean, you're supposed to believe in the other one, but you're only supposed to follow one.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah.
Only mentioning this one, and yeah. I don't remember who says that. Yeah, it's Salada's son who mentions a crew with no tongues would be even better than
and
major for sure.
Yes.
Is a crew with no tongues.
Yeah. It's coming, guys.
Yeah, so Euron has the right idea. And
Marie, I saw that and I was like,
the second time we hear about the horn that wakes krakens from the deep. And I feel like if it had just once, it would have been like this throwaway line. But it being such a significant mention a second time, I feel like we should be, you know,
wondering if it's the horn of German.
Yeah.
Nadia, what was the first one?
It's also where Aurene Water is laded.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, with the Drummonds?
Did he actually read it? Or is he just... Didn't he, like, just go to the Narrow Sea and start pirating?
I think he went to the Narrow Sea, yeah. He didn't stop at... But maybe... I don't know. Regarding the horns, though, I think it's really more... George being like, I mean, he mentions different horns at different places during the story, and he makes a point of mentioning more than one and mentioning them more than once, so that we are like, who is this, the horn of Jorman? And I mean, there's a lot of possibilities for that. There's the random horn they found at the Fist of the First Men. There's the one that Euron has, right? There's this one.
Which do you think will
know.
Work?
Davos has this moment where he walks out and he smells the sea and he just wishes that he could sail back to his wife with and take a son with him. And it's remarkable how this person is managing to move on despite his four of his sons dying. But in this chapter, like, you get the full weight of it when he's comparing Devon to his first son, and it's like it's just, even though it's just like one line, but it's so painful almost that
Davos Leo, he is delightful for version of the fanaticism trope. I was just saying that he was a delightful aversion to the normal fanatic in fantasy. In that he's honest, stands up for what he believes in, and wishes to both serve and better his king. On top of that, he's a good dad.
Yeah, I feel like this is why he's one of the most loved characters.
And I also feel like this is why Stannis appreciates him so much and has the position he has. So.
Yeah, he's like the perfect balance to Melisandre.
I mean, he's like almost a perfect everything. Like, I feel like his character is almost too good to be true in this world.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite characters, which I feel like is a bit of a lame choice, but I do just really like him, so...
Even though he does admit at one point that he has cheated multiple times on his wife, whom he loves very much.
Which I think is awful, but I also think in the context of this world, I'm not that I'm justifying
and considering this time he spends away from his wife.
It's like, there's...
It's still horrible, but...
There's no excuse for it, but there is also... Yeah, I don't think that excuses it, but I also think it's worth considering it in the context of the general setting, which is
he's been away from her for what, years? I mean, it's just crazy. Just let him go home and go back to his remaining sons.
Yeah, but it's also wonderful to see how proud he is of his son. Like when he admits that he doesn't feel like a lord. But he was like, this, my son is going to be a good lord because he's going to have the education and he's obviously being raised alongside a princess and a king's bastard. So he's going to have the opportunity to be a decent like lord of the Rainwood. Yeah, and also that I love the fact that Davos is learning how to read because he wants to feel equal to the other lords surrounding Stannis. And it's nice to see him take some steps towards that.
Yeah, and it's incredible how, I mean, Pylos makes a point that anyone can learn how to read. It's not something reserved to that only the highborn can do. Like any man can learn, and the whole speech about what Davos has to give to Stannis is just inspiring. Like he doesn't need lords, he doesn't need knights, he doesn't need he needs someone with honesty and good sense, and that's what Davos has.
I also like that we're being shown this. I do like when these themes kind of come up of the class differences, I guess.
Yeah.
And most of the time we deal with characters who can obviously read and it's not really something we think about. But I like when we're shown that this isn't how Westeros.
This isn't Westeros,
yeah.
It was actually kind of funny to me to imagine just not being able to read, and because it feels so natural and familiar. I don't even remember learning. It's like I always knew. So it's kind of weird to, like, I would have no idea how to teach someone how to read.
Yeah.
Melisandre, when she's supposedly speaking about Stannis, he says that one of her prophecies was a hero reborn in the sea, and also the other one is that living dragons hatch from dead stone. So could her prophecies not be referring to one person but multiple people? And would it be a tad ironic if one of those people was Davos?
Oh yeah, the reborn at the sea thing. That would be cool.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind if at the end of this, like, Davos turned out to be the real hero. I love Davos.
I'd be so okay with that.
The real hero. Yeah.
I'd be so on board with that.
And this is also the chapter where he reads the letter from the Night's Watch, and this is kind of like the turning point in Stannis' story, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and it's amazing how Pylos already showed this letter to Axel, Florent, and Selyse. And like, nobody cares. Like, they sent this letter to all of the five kings, and nobody cared about it. Like, they didn't even give it a second thought. Davos is the only one who can, like, who can understand how horrifying this news is.
Well, do you think Stannis knew about it? Because Melisandre, as soon as she finds out about it, pretty much tells him to go. But it was Maester who just handed it to him later. So do you think the Maester conspiracy thing could be true and they were trying to hide it?
No, I feel like he already did the right thing, right? He showed it to Stannis' hand. And yeah, the hand chose not to pass it on to Stannis. So I feel like Pylos is, we've already seen him be so sensible that I don't think he's the kind of character to hide something from the king intentionally.
Yeah, I agree.
Insane is it though that Stannis listens to the man who is illiterate and it completely changes his game after such a massive defeat at Blackwater, that he listens to this one little piece of information and then completely changes his prospects. That all it depended upon was a man wanting to better himself. And it was a man that he trusted, no doubt, but this one little thing, it just completely changed. I mean, Stannis then goes on to turn his fortunes around just based on this one little kind of minor detail, you know, Davos learning how to read.
It sounds even more awesome when you put it like that.
Yeah. But that remains to be seen, right? Like, it's at this point, at the point we are at the end of the fifth book, Stannis is kind of stranded in the snow and it doesn't have that big a force of armed men, and so he's moving in the right direction because he was basically doing nothing on Dragonstone and had no way of gaining any more lords and people to his cause. So obviously it's really a great turning point for him, but it remains to be seen if it will really be his fortune or not, I think.
Well, as you say, I mean, he had no prospects on Dragonstone. He was stuck between a rock and an even bigger rock. And then place on the side as well. He had no chance of progressing. Whereas this kind of northern campaign gave him an extra lifeline almost.
Yeah, and a purpose. And
exactly, yeah. It's I don't know, I love this moment just for the fact that from nothing, Stannis then becomes a player again.
Yeah.
And also I feel like in this chapter, Davos is becoming kind of like, he's starting to play the game. Like, he's kind of sneakily going off to find the king's men and bring them over to his side. So he's also like really getting into being the hand. So now we're jumping ahead 4 chapters to Tyrion 7, which happens on the 1st of January in the year 300. I feel like we've spent an eternity in 299, so it's good to finally reach 300. Anyway, Tanya?
So basically Tyrion wakes up next to Sansa and thinks a bit about her and their relationship and how she reacted to when he told her of Rob's death, because she basically didn't show much of a reaction at all. And then later, when she was in a different room, he heard her cry and thought about trying to comfort her, but then figured it probably wouldn't go down very well because of the whole his family killing her family thing. And he does seem to be quite bitter about the whole state of their marriage, which is maybe understandable, I guess. I don't know. But it's not much better for her either, I guess. And then he goes to that room where they store all the dragon skulls and spends some quality time with Shay, who is now one of Sansa's maids. Varys arranged that, but also told Tyrion that he wasn't going to lie to Cersei about it if she were to ask who Shay was. Tyrion thinks about all sorts of things, like telling Sansa about Shay, or marrying Shay off to various people. He considers arranging for her to marry Bronn, but then at some point he decides to arrange for her to marry a hedge knight that's serving Joffrey. And the chapter ends with him making that decision. And that's it.
Yeah, this chapter is very short.
There's not much happening.
And there's
a short chapter.
Yeah, there's nothing happening.
Tyrion fucks Jay. Done.
Santa Claus Lord.
I don't have... Oh, yeah, Santa Claus Lord. Which is fair. I'd probably cry a lot if my brother died, so...
And mother.
And mother, yeah.
And mother.
Extremely brutally murdered.
Yeah. It's just... Yeah. I cannot imagine how Sansa... I mean, can survive this. It's just Ned and then Rob and Caitlin. It's so brutal, so cruel, so like she must be so low right now.
Oh yeah, like there's no, like at this point she knows that no one's coming for her. Like as long as Rob was alive, there was the hope that he would win, he would defeat the Lannisters, he would eventually get around to rescuing her. But now there's no hope. Like, it's nobody's coming for her anymore. Nobody cares about her anymore, except for the fact that she is the heir to Winterfell. That's all they care about. And it's like, it's a very, it's unbelievable that she doesn't give in to, like she's had suicidal tendencies before. Like, she's considered suicide before. And it's amazing that. But maybe she does have, like, the Dauntless thing in the background happening. Like, she knows she can finally get out of King's Landing, so maybe that has something to do with it. But
I wonder what there is even for her to get to at this stage. I don't really know what there is for her to look forward or who she would want to see again.
Yeah, I don't think she cares anymore. She just wants to get out.
I mean, of course. Yeah, sure. But in terms of other options, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I mean, technically, her aunt is still alive, right? Her wonderful, loving aunt.
Yeah.
Fantastic option.
Yeah, it works out really well for her.
I mean, it's hard for all the Stark children and for Arya and Jon. I mean, but Sansa has to witness all of it within the Lannister family, and it's just, I mean, it's no wonder that she cannot bring herself to look at Tyrion and to even envision trusting him and having an actual relationship with him.
Do you
guys think this is where, this is the moment where Sansa becomes, she turns from pawn to player, because she loses everything, and maybe subconsciously or just based on her situation, she realizes that she has to make things happen for herself.
It might be the first step in that development, but I don't know.
I don't think that's
when the change happens.
No.
Maybe it's like a prerequisite, or like it flips some sort of switch. But
I think it's when she realizes that she played a part in Joffrey's death without even knowing it, and that's the point where she's tired of being used and decides to. I mean, it's the beginning of her taking charge and trying to understand what's happening around her.
Yeah, even the whole Dauntless plan is basically just happening to her, right?
He came to
the plan, and she just agreed to go along with it. But I think this Rob's death means that there's no going back from that.
Yeah, so I think it sets her on the whole path. I don't think this is specifically where any change happens, but I do think it sets her off in that direction.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I guess I only suggest that because, I mean, she had that when Sandor came to her in the Battle of the Blackwater. She had the opportunity to escape, whereas now maybe when eventually Dauntless presents her with an opportunity to escape, she's maybe a bit more willing because she knows she has no other opportunity, really.
I think it's more that she has nothing to lose. At the Blackwater, she's really depressed at the time too, but yeah, there's still the hope that Rob will come and save her. There's the hope that if, I mean, she doesn't know what will happen if Stannis wins. I mean, and now it's just, please get me out of there because there's nothing there's nothing worse than can happen to her if they catch her, and so she might as well try it.
Yeah. There's also something I noticed that's probably very exciting for some fanfic writers, but I need to find the start of the chapter again. Sorry, I should have looked for the start of the chapter first before I started saying anything. There's something about, so when Tyrion wakes up, there's something about her talking in her sleep and like saying a name or something. Sorry, I'm not
Trandor.
I don't know if he doesn't say that, but I'm assuming that there's fanfic that builds on this particular sentence. Hold on, chapter 15.
I'm sure there is.
I'm sure there is.
I mean, at this point, there's fanfic about everything.
She dreams, he thought, when Sansa murmured something softly. A name, perhaps, though it was too faint to say. That Stannis. Seems like something... Gross.
Please, no.
Not that.
Sonia, I hate to ruin your fanfic, but in that the very next chapter, we hear that Sansa is dreaming about Winterfell and she's running with Lady. So,
well... Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. Dreams aren't always consistent. Okay, I don't know. It wasn't my fanfic anyway.
It's the same dream because these two chapters are happening at the same time.
Sure, but you don't know. Yeah. But it's not like I'm big on fanfic at all.
Anyway.
I was just saying that I'm sure there's fanfics that feed off of this sentence. So
really not much happens.
No, that's true.
But we get one endless internal monologue of Tyrion being all guilty about Shay, and I should stop, and I shouldn't love her, and she's a whore, and she deserves better than me, and she's gonna die if I keep doing this, but oh fuck, I can't stop it, I love her too much. It's just, can we stop with this, please?
But I feel like in every chapter, Tyrion tries to convince himself that Shay is a whore. She doesn't love him. She's only in this for whatever gifts and money he's giving her. But then it always ends with, but I love her so much.
Yeah. And I think it's both annoying and actually realistic because, I mean, we do lie to ourselves about this kind of things. And I mean, it's very dependent on everyone's character, but anyway, it makes sense that he's not immediately being like, okay, it's decided, I'm stopping this, and that he goes through with it, but it gets tedious at some point.
Yeah, the question is how much do we need to read about it? It's one thing of how much he's actually doing it, but how often
yeah,
do we
exactly.
need to read it?
The end of the chapter is Tyrion being like, okay, I survived everything that's been going on. I can very well survive Joffrey's wedding. And this is going to be the turning point for his arc. So, I mean, it's very gloomy, the end of the chapter. Like, we're in a new century, a new era. It's Joffrey's wedding. And it's the start of the last part of A Storm of Swords. So... at least, oh, yeah. I think that's the point of the chapter. Like, it's not much use for everything else, but it sets you off in 300.
But how much of that do you perceive when you're reading the book, though? I mean, I guess
maybe not...
we're very aware of the timeline, obviously. But...
yeah, but I mean, it's the same with the whole... It's part of what is interesting in Martin's story is that it's so tight and very well orchestrated. And obviously you don't realize that on a first read, but you do when you reread. So that's why it's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not convinced that this chapter was entirely necessary.
I think at least its point in the narration is to, like, to start off Joffrey's wedding day.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it's just like a transition chapter. Yeah. Okay, so anyone else have anything?
She could be dreaming of Winterfell and the Hound could still be there or something, or Stannis or whatever people want to write fanfics about.
But he's not Tanya. She's dreaming of about her father. That would be really creepy.
Oh, gross. Yeah. I know someone else who thinks about people he wants to bang and relatives of his, but I'm not allowed to say.
For anyone who's reading along, the next episode will cover Sansa 4, Tyrion 8, and Sansa 5 from A Storm of Swords. Thanks for joining us, everyone. If you want to find VOK, we're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our website is vokpodcast.wordpress.com, and you can always find us at the Podcast of Ice and Fire forums. Thanks for joining us. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for hosting, bye. Nadia.
Thank you.
I actually genuinely had a Shay-related query. So how many of you guys think that she was placed there by Tywin or Varys or someone?
Placed where? What?
Back in the Green Fork. Oh.
I feel like Tywin was angry enough about it that it at least couldn't have been him. And I think Varys is...
but then he slept with her.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that happened only after, like, I don't know when it happened, but I feel like it happened after Tyrion was arrested.
Well, no, it clearly did, but I mean, how I feel like it's too similar to Tysha in some ways.
Well, Tywin didn't sleep with Tysha, but.
No. Of course not. But I mean, it's just too similar how he set him up for it.
Do you think so? How is it similar?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he made it such a big deal of, oh, you must not bring this girl to court. I mean, he used more derogatory terms, but you must not bring this lady to court. She will. Yeah, I do not approve. Obviously, knowing that Tyrion's gonna go against him, and it was almost some sort of weird, twisted Tywin-esque test.
I feel like Shay doesn't exactly seem like the smartest person. And it could obviously, if she's a spy, I suppose it could be a persona, but I don't feel like she's like spy material, really.
So I mean, what would the purpose of that be anyway? And what purpose have we seen it serve in any way?
It's not like... I don't see how Tywin would take advantage of that.
Yeah. Well, the advantage would be that he could denounce Tyrion as Hand of the King, and he could take away a lot of what he has gained in Tywin's absence.
What does he need to? Like, Tywin is Hand anyway, right? Like, Tyrion only derives his power from Tywin, so it's not like he has any for himself.
Well, Tywin, I know, but I mean, away, I feel like Tywin needs that final nail in the coffin.
And also, Tyrion is so hated in King's Landing that honestly, you don't need anything else.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
Everyone hates him anyway.
I don't know. I guess maybe it's just Tywin being that sort of, you know, kind of like Littlefinger, where anything that goes wrong is like, oh, well, maybe it's Littlefinger. Well, I think, you know, or maybe it's Tywin who's being this complete massive arsehole and ruining Tyrion's life and making him think all these things. Certainly when his love life comes into question.
I think not everything is completely orchestrated. I think it's more interesting to think that what already happened in Tyrion's love life is shaping whatever is happening now. And like he repeats the same pattern, even though Tysha wasn't actually a whore. He repeats that.
Yeah.
I think it's happenstance, really. No.
And I feel like the startings of their, I don't know, if you can call it a relationship, but Tyrion basically just sends Bronn to find a whore that's relatively clean and bring it back to him. Bring her back to him. I did not mean to say that.
Nadia, oh my god.
Anyways, I don't feel like it was orchestrated. Bronn just found a whore, and that was it.
That's the impression I get.
But then you've got to question where Bronn comes from, and where his loyalty lies, which is in the gold.
Bronn is a spy.
Well, I don't know.
I like Bronn.
I mean, we've got to question all these assholes except Davos, who is king.
Well, I think you can be pretty certain the POV characters are who they say they are.
Yeah.
Davos for president, hashtag 2020.
But how often does this happen? Like, it only happens with the Kettle Blacks, right? That we find out that that they owe their allegiance to Littlefinger and not to anyone else. Like Cersei thinks the Kettle Blacks are hers and whatnot, but they're actually in Littlefinger's pocket, employ. Basically. But does it happen with any other characters that they suddenly turn out to be spies? I don't think so, right?
Well, not yet.
It's not something that
Cersei is supposedly best buddies with.
Tena Maria?
Yes.
But that hasn't been proven yet.
Because of course her devotion is pure.
No. She's just trying to advance herself. It's not like she's spying for anyone else. She was just trying to advance her own family. That was it. I feel like that was a motivation, not anything else. She doesn't take back information to anyone, right?
Well,
we think it's Baileys.
Nah, I agree with Nadia on Tena Maria.
I mean, yeah, I feel like we've spent so much time discussing these chapters that we start to pick everything apart. We start questioning everyone's motives.
That's what happens if you don't get a book in a reasonable amount of time.
Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. That was my point.
Yep.
When you spend 5 years analysing this, or many more for other people, you start to question your questions.
You start to question everything. Yeah.
I mean, who's to say that Bran isn't a spy?
Well,
maybe Jaime Lannister walked into him and pushed him off of that tower.
That is entirely possible.
That's actually a freebie.
Obviously, Jaime walked into him, and then Bran fell off, died, and then Jaime took over his body, and then actually this Jaime is actually Cersei, and then whoever is in Cersei's body is, I don't know,
can you
drunk and doing Father. Some bullshit.
No, please don't repeat it.
It's Robert and Cersei, because he's also drunk all the time. And he wants a lot of the same things Cersei wants.
Robert, no!
Of course,
so everyone reincarnates into someone. Okay, right.